Welcome to the second episode in our two-part series on imposter phenomenon and how to help your learners manage it. Dr. Tara Feinstad and Dr. Addie McClintock have teamed up to develop a two-prong approach to help us help our learners manage the impact of this phenomenon. In the first episode, Dr. Tara Feinstad set the stage for us, describing what imposter phenomenon is, how to recognize it in individuals, and tips for one-on-one interactions with our learners, encouraging the normalizing of the struggle, encouraging absorbing praise, and discouraging comparison with others and perfectionist thinking. Dr. Addie McClintock is joining me today. Dr. McClintock is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She practices at the University of Washington's Women's Healthcare Center, where she also runs the Women's Health Training Pathway for the internal medicine residency. Her academic interests are in the clinical learning environment, feedback, and bias in assessment. In the second episode, she will be broadening the conversation to describe how we can design the learning environment to create psychological safety and thus counter imposter phenomenon by creating healthy and functional teams.
Addie, welcome. Thank you for being our guest on this second of a two-part podcast on imposter phenomenon. Let's start with the same question that I asked Tyra in the first podcast, and that's, how did you get here?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here today. Really, this all started as an interest in feedback, like Tyra. She and I were working together quite a lot on learning more about how to give feedback, how to seek feedback, how to focus on a growth mindset in your trainees and in ourselves. But what I realized as I was doing that was that the feedback and how you give it and what you say are important, but the things that really matter are also the structures that you set up around your learners and the relationships that you build with them as part of that feedback and growth process. And the way that we model and normalize learning as part of the path to mastery is really important, and probably even more important than what you say or sometimes how you even say it, in terms of whether trainees feel prepared to receive the feedback and what amount of credibility they give it and how they respond to it. So all of this led to my interest in psychological safety, which we'll talk more about, but I realized that you can sort of use this concept and the tools that come from it to build these environments that make everybody feel valued and part of a team. And building that sense of belonging has a really powerful effect on ameliorating imposter phenomenon. So that's how I got here today. And mostly, you know, whereas Tyra talked a lot about what an educator can do on a one-on-one basis, what I want to talk about today is really how you can build an environment that just doesn't provide any fuel for that imposter phenomenon and really is about making people feel like they belong and that their ideas are wanted and welcome and are an important part of the care that we provide.
Thank you. We're glad you're here today. I think the concept of psychological safety might be not really familiar to some of our listeners. Would you like to explain a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, sure. So according to Amy Edmondson, who is the person who initially coined the term, psychological safety describes a climate where people feel safe to take interpersonal risks by speaking up, sharing concerns, questions, or ideas without the fear of personal consequences like being blamed, shamed, or ignored. And it's a team level phenomenon. So it's created and exists at the level of a group or a team. But I also want to emphasize that it's an internal state. It's a belief by a team member that the group is safe and supportive.
As a team leader, how does one create a psychologically safe environment, learning environment?
Yeah, psychological safety very much depends on our team leaders, and they have to set the group norms and then be responsible for upholding them. So as educators and attending physicians, we are team leaders. Even if it's just us and one student, we have a role there as a leader. And people make decisions about, you know, safe or unsafe really quickly. And they base it on a lot of the interpersonal interactions between, you know, them and the leader or how the leader is interacting with others. And so the quality of the relationships on a team and between the team members is a really important driver of psychological safety within a team. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there are some specific tasks that people can do as well.
Are there some simple and straightforward things that educators can do to make a learning environment psychologically safe?
Yes. Yeah, so Amy Edmondson says that there are three core leadership tasks that create psychological safety. And these three tasks are set the stage, invite participation, and respond productively. So setting the stage is the first task, and it has subtasks of its own. The first task is to frame the work. And this is where leaders can set expectations about failure and uncertainty and clarify the need for voice and frame the work as an ongoing process. This is where leaders generate shared expectations and meaning about the work by emphasizing the purpose and the importance of a team approach. Mm-hmm. In medical education, this translates to setting expectations with learners about what type of work you want them to do and how or when. It also gives them a clear sense of how to be successful in your time together, which frees up some of that mental energy that Tyra was talking about that might otherwise go into guessing what you expect from them or guessing how to be successful. And then an explicit statement that learning and progress towards independent practice and excellent patient care are the underlying motivators for the work you are doing is really critical so that they always understand what your motivations are when you are interacting. And then it can also really help to give a description, a sort of an explicit description of your own teaching style, which again, just helps trainees understand kind of where you're coming from when you're, you know, doing something, for example, like just asking them questions. And this can really change the experience of you asking them a question from sort of embarrassment or shame to not knowing about something to more like, oh, wow, like they want to know what I know so that they can build on that. And I'm learning here. This is so great. So it can really change the experience of the learner to understand what your motivations are when you're talking to them.
It's so good to be reminded of that, Addie. Setting the stage clearly and concretely is obviously key, but it's often the first thing that gets jettisoned when there's time pressures, especially in early phases of their education. It's like, oh, no time to explain it. We've got to get to the meat of the presentation. And it's good for us to keep in mind how important that first task is.
It does. And it often gets lost. And I think part of that is because over the years, our work becomes so naturalized that we can't even remember not knowing how to do it or how we learned to do it. So for students, it's all new. And we kind of forget that too. It's probably some self-preservation to forget what medical school was like or residency in some cases. But taking the time to explain a trainee's role and your expectations goes a really long way. Again, just towards what Tyra pointed out earlier about clear standards for themselves. This doesn't have to be a long drawn out thing to the point of time pressure. It really can be, you know, I often do it in like a fast talking 3 minutes with a new student in clinic, for example. And I think it is really helpful for them to just understand what they are going to be doing and how to do it well.
Great. Thank you. It's good to hear that it doesn't have to be a long time and it helps to be a fast talker. I understand. So what's the second task?
Inviting participation is the second task. And the main goal of this task is to really demonstrate humility and practice inquiry and set up structures and processes for input. So this step is where a leader invites input from others on the team and asks them to speak up if they see safety issues or they have questions or concerns. It's also a place where team leaders can model a growth mindset and demonstrate that practice is the path to competency. In medical education, inviting participation isn't just, you know, you asking questions, but it's making trainees aware that questions from them are welcome as part of the learning and the patient care process and inviting participation in the patient care itself. So this is where team leaders can include trainees in the care process, be that through asking questions of them or letting them demonstrate their knowledge so that you can understand their learning needs, or just creating opportunities for trainees to be a genuine part of patient care through supported autonomy.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm hearing a subtext of curiosity and openness is important. So I like that.
Absolutely.
Inviting participation can be challenging though. And I think we've noticed that in some online environments, especially recently. But do you have any general tips to share when participation isn't as quickly coming as you might want it to be?
Yeah, it can take a lot of forms, I think, in medical education. Ultimately, what we want to do is make people feel welcome and create opportunities for trainees to have a genuine and meaningful role in patient care. So, you know, the first part of making people feel welcome is just welcoming them. You know, when you have new team members, just a simple like, oh, great, we have two medical students on our team today. Welcome. We're so happy to have you. You have such an important role on our team. You know, again, simple, quick statements that aren't a long, drawn out conversation, but just make someone know that they are wanted there. Tyra mentioned normalizing the struggle, and this is really true here too. Humility goes a long way. It says to people that just because you think this is hard doesn't mean you don't belong here. I thought this was hard too. I still think this is hard. And it tells them that this is a part of the process of becoming a doctor, that you're feeling this way doesn't mean that you don't belong here. And then providing trainees with supported autonomy, so giving them ways to be part of the decision-making or the patient care, as long as it's not unsafe, letting trainees make the decisions, even if it's not exactly how you would have done it, I think goes a long way towards making people feel like their opinion is valued and part of the patient care that you're giving. And when you're giving autonomy, at the same time, let them know that you're there if they need you. This idea of like, I believe that you can do this. And if you need help, I'm here. Please call me anytime. So even if in the moment you maybe can't provide autonomy, it's a quick decision that needs to be made. It's a high stakes situation. You can always go back and talk to trainees about that decision later and help them understand what was going on by sort of describing your process and what was happening. And so even though maybe they couldn't be a part of the care at that time, that's a way to include them and invite them into what was happening and help create still sort of some teaching point for them at a later time.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we've set the stage, we've invited and got participation under the best circumstances. And what's the next task?
So responding productively is the third leadership task. And this is a really important one. This is where leadership upholds their promise. This is where we can express appreciation and listen to those who've taken the risk to ask a question or to speak up. We destigmatize mistakes and reframe them as chances to look forward and do something differently next time. Mm-hmm. And as educators, we help students and trainees consider next steps or a different course of action in the future. And then lastly, responding productively includes sanctioning group norms. For example, if a supervising attending sets the tone that all questions are welcome, and then a senior resident embarrasses a more junior team member, the role of the team leader there is to make it clear to that senior resident that that behavior is not welcome on your team and to reestablish the safety for those junior team members when things like that happen.
Mm-hmm. Great. So we've got three tasks and good concrete examples and tips. Is there anything else that you want to add about creating psychological safety in the learning environment?
Yeah, two other underlying principles I just want to touch on that are really important in psychological safety, but aren't explicitly touched on in those three steps are the ideas about relationships and power within the team. So having high quality relationships with team members is a really big part of creating a cohesive team where people feel safe and understood and welcome. And small things like getting to know your team, asking about their interests outside of medicine can go a really long way towards making people feel like you care about them and you are genuinely interested in them. And then power. In medicine, as Tyra also mentioned, we have these really deeply entrenched cultural norms of hierarchy. And in some cases, we have very strict norms around who has the power to speak, whose ideas matter, whose ideas are taken seriously. And we may even have very common patterns about how we respond to when others do speak up. So I do usually really like to emphasize that psychological safety is kind of a contract between higher ranking and lower ranking team members. But in reality, creating psychological safety has to start with an active process of culture change from the top, especially in medicine. And so it has to start with leaders really inviting others to speak up and with lower ranking team members sort of agreeing to speak up. And then leaders acknowledge and thank those who have asked questions or raised concerns, and really breaking down this traditional hierarchy structure and sharing power with traditionally sort of lower ranking team members is a really important part of the work that has to be done to create psychological safety.
Wow. Sort of sounds a bit revolutionary, but wonderful. So thank you, Addie. We have a really clear picture. I think you painted a really clear picture of how to set up a psychologically safe learning environment. Can we shift our focus a little now and discuss how you see psychological safety relating to imposter phenomenon?
Sure, of course. So we know that certain behaviors by supervising physicians can really exacerbate imposter phenomenon. And some of these behaviors are micromanaging or even sort of the worst offense of, you know, only letting someone shadow. And then blaming an individual when things go wrong or shaming someone for not knowing things, sort of comments like, well, a third year really should know this. And then also highly rigid power structures and hierarchy in teams is another thing that can really exacerbate imposter phenomenon. And then finally, sort of escalating a person's responsibility without any clear expectations or sort of inadequate supervision. Those are all things that can really exacerbate imposter phenomenon for our trainees. Many of these behaviors, really what they're sending, the sort of message that they're sending a trainee when these things happen is saying, you're not trusted. You don't know what you're doing. You don't really belong here, or you're doing it wrong. So a supervisor doing these things is really pushing all of those imposter phenomenon buttons for people and can be really detrimental to how learners feel in the learning environment. On the other hand, when we hear these, and then we think about the behaviors we just talked about that promote safety, you can see that these are really two sides of the same coin. So learners report feeling sort of, I'll say, less impostery when leaders sort of align with the psychological safety framework, because those behaviors are designed to send the message of, we value your input, we need it, and we trust you, and we want to help you reach your goals. So it's really the behaviors themselves are kind of the exact opposites of each other that both create and then imposter phenomenon, or create psychological safety and kind of reduce imposter phenomenon.
Great. How else does psychological safety support medical trainees and reduce imposter phenomenon?
Really, it's about ensuring optimal learning and normalizing the learning process for trainees so that, again, that inner critic doesn't have too much material to work with. Mm-hmm. Psychological safety supports a learning culture by promoting curiosity, humility, candor, reinforcing the interdependence of what we do, and emphasizing process improvement over perfection, like Tyra was talking about. And we know also that psychological safety, when it's there, it can reduce the external cognitive load that trainees have in their mind about grading and evaluation, image, fear of mistakes. And this frees up a lot of mental space to just focus on learning. So setting the stage helps tamper that perfectionism that Tyra was talking about in our last podcast. And it really defines the standard. And then a learner can see sort of where they are and have a clear benchmark of where they want to go. And then inviting participation, a big part of that, like I mentioned before, is modeling humility. And this can be acknowledging that you don't know something or making sort of explicit the work and the practice that you've done to get where you are. And again, just normalizes the learning process and helps trainees see that being a doctor doesn't just, you don't just become one overnight. It's a long process of becoming a doctor through study, practice, and repetition, which they do know, but can be really easy to forget when you feel like you have to work harder than everyone else for half the result. So helping trainees see learning and training more clearly as a process can really reduce those feelings of failure when things don't go the way they think they should. And instead of the sort of compare and despair like Tyra was talking about, and that isolation and self-doubt that I don't belong here, when trainees go to compare to another person, they can see clearly that actually this isn't just me. It's not that I don't belong here or that something is wrong. It's that this is the expected process that I go through as a trainee. And then responding productively helps people see what has gone well and frame the feedback as an investment in their growth and not what I would call a blame fest. And Tyra mentioned that as well, sort of helping people to see the praise and absorb the praise. It really minimizes the, again, the amount of fuel that you're giving that inner critic who really only wants to pick out the negative and not kind of absorb that positive and think about the work and the progress that they've made. So, and remember that for students, mistakes are, of course, clinical mistakes, but they're also just wrong answers, saying something that leads to an embarrassing, you know, publicly embarrassing moment in the OR. They can be things that we as the supervising physicians think of as really minor. So as Tyra said earlier, really avoiding comparing trainees, sort of instead using your stated expectations and emphasizing individual trainee growth and progress, rather than sort of a comparison-based approach of third years should blah when you're communicating assessments. That's another way to just give useful and helpful feedback that really discourages trainees from comparing themselves to others as well.
Wow, I would love to see that structural approach be transmitted backwards into the foundational phase. It's like instead of this, you know, X percentage and you're on your average or you're below or above average, it would be such a relief to be teaching in a framework like the one that you've laid out compared to what we do. Anyway, thank you for making all those links back to Tyra's podcast, the first podcast in the series. We've covered a huge amount of ground. Thank you. But perhaps we can rein it in a little bit and I'll do to you what I did to Tyra and ask you for some very concrete tips on what you have for educators who want to start building a psychologically safe learning environment today when we walk into the classroom an hour from now.
So my number one, two, and three really is build relationships with your team members. When trainees feel that their supervisors are invested in them and invested in their learning and development, almost all of that cognitive crosstalk that I mentioned earlier goes away. Mm-hmm. So the relationships make a really big difference to trainees in terms of how they feel on the team. My official number two is early on in team formation, really making an explicit statement that learning is the priority of this team. Describe your teaching style so that trainees understand the motivation behind any of the interpersonal interactions later. So when you ask them questions or engage in a dialogue for the purposes of teaching, they understand sort of where that's coming from. And then lower the stakes on not knowing what or how, sort of tell them that it's okay not to know and sort of frame it as like, oh, great. Well, then here I have something to teach you. Number three is to set expectations for your learners. These can be really things, again, that you think of as minor. What should they do each day? Where to go if they need to ask a question? Who is available for help and when they need it? This also sort of minimizes the crosstalk about, am I doing it right? What should I be doing? Do I really belong here if I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing? It's all just really clear for them and helps make that very obvious to them. Number four, give autonomy and what I say, allow for style. So don't micromanage. If a decision is not unsafe or has a risk of harm, and it's not causing unacceptable variations in care, allow trainees to develop their own style of practice and to make decisions where it feels safe. For your own comfort, these can be really low stakes decisions, or they can even be just a, what would you do here, whether you intend to follow that as a suggestion or not.
Thought experiment, yeah.
Right, thought experiments, exactly. But give them the opportunity to have sort of authentic, developmentally appropriate autonomy. And it really ultimately shows them that you trust them. And then the last one, just model humility, lifelong learning, and a growth mindset. So if you don't know something, say, I don't know when you don't know. Ask other team members if they know. Again, from an imposter phenomenon standpoint, this really normalizes the difficult and hugely daunting task of becoming a doctor and reduces that power distance that we mentioned earlier.
Oh, thank you. I so enjoyed these two podcasts because it seems like everything you said ties into sort of something in the whole landscape of medical education. It's like there's so many directions that you can go with from this imposter phenomenon strategies for dealing with that and psychological safety. And it's so wonderful to be reminded of those things because, as you mentioned, we just tend to forget them and move on without a lot of mindfulness about it. So thank you for that. So in summary, we could say for psychological safety, we can focus on who we are holistically as leaders and team members, why we're here to learn, what the expectations are. We can allow for developmentally appropriate autonomy and we can be humble. And I think I heard you say curious as well somewhere in there. Yeah. And that'll all go a long way towards creating the learning environment that will be best for our learners and really best for us as teachers too. I think faculty has struggled with a learning environment that's not been properly nurtured and crafted. And so thank you for those tips.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dr. Addie McClintock, for sharing your wisdom and tips. Any last thoughts?
I'll just add a mother's advice from my own mother. And even though I was not part of Tyra's podcast, my other tip that I just really love for trainees in general and us as practicing physicians is not to compare our insides to other people's outsides. So the anxiety and the fear and the not belonging that we may feel in ourselves, just because you can't see it on someone else's forehead written, it doesn't mean it's not there. And to remember that, you know, much of what people struggle with from the standpoint of imposter phenomenon really is happening all around us, and to not feel that that means something about you in particular.
Great. Thank you. No, nothing like a mother's wisdom.
Agreed.
Thanks very much.
I hope you've enjoyed the second in the two-part series on imposter phenomenon. Please consult the CLIME website if you'd like some suggestions for resources and further reading.